Hello, I'm James Kamara-Sami. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Wednesday the 9th of October. As Florida braces for the arrival of Hurricane Milton, billed as the storm of the century, we speak to a local sheriff and hear from a resident who's decided to ride it out. Only two runners are left in the race to become the leader of the opposition. As that contest goes out to party members, we ask two grassroots Tories what they make of Robert Jenrick and Kemi Badenoch. As the leaders of Israel and the United States have their first phone call in weeks, Jeremy Bowen has been speaking to a former Israeli PM who wants his country to attack Iran's nuclear sites and captured in a piece of classical music for the first time, the beauty of Bognor Regis. There are now just a few hours to go until what has been billed as the storm of the century hits the west coast of Florida. The sounds of high winds and rain as the outer edge of Hurricane Milton has already made its presence felt along a coastline only recently ravaged by the deadly Hurricane Helene. Accompanying tornadoes have already twisted across the state of Florida, and there are reports of flooding even before the storm has made landfall. Millions of people have left their homes and officials are preparing for the worst.
While there is the hope that it will weaken more before landfall, there is high confidence that this hurricane is going to pack a major, major punch.
I know it's really tough leaving behind your home, your belongings, everything you own, but I urge everyone in Hurricane Milton's path to follow all safety instructions as we head to the next 24 hours.
This is very different than anything that we have seen. And then when you combine that much storm surge with 155 mile an hour winds and then rain on top of that, that might be another 12 inches or so. It's going to be really, really devastating.
We heard there from the mayor of Sarasota in Florida, Liz Alpert. Before that, President Biden and the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis. Well, Tara Callaghan is a reporter with America's National Public Radio. She joins us now live from Fort Myers in Florida. Tara, welcome to the program. What are the conditions like where you are at the moment?
Yeah, so right now and over the last few hours, we've been experiencing heavy rainfall with tropical storm force winds spreading, you know, inland and, you know, across the Florida Peninsula. We've even seen recent wind gusts on Fort Myers Beach of about 68 miles per hour already, and the storm has not yet officially really made landfall anywhere. Multiple tornadoes have been sighted throughout counties across southwest Florida, including very near the station where I'm at right now. So we are continuing to monitor, and just at that 5 p.m. update, it is approaching at a Category 3.
Category 3, I think Hurricane Katrina was something like a Category 3 as well. It's a storm surge, that those unusually high sea levels that people are concerned about, isn't it?
Yes, very much so, especially considering Helene. Storm surge, we can be seeing anywhere from 5 feet up to 12 feet. We have some areas here in southwest Florida that may be experiencing even maybe as high as projected 13 feet of storm surge, which is, of course, the most deadly part of a hurricane. With the flooding that Helene had already seen, with the rains that have been persistent, and now with what's onslaught, we are definitely preparing the best that we can.
And Hurricane Helene left in its wake a lot of debris as well, didn't it? That presumably is something that could cause a lot of damage to the property, but also to any people who have decided to stay.
Definitely. We had reporters out in the field, even coming from areas, Port Charlotte, Florida, here to the station. They were still seeing mountains of debris in the roads. What that turns into is deadly projectiles through hurricane force winds. And the cleanup of that, I mean, I believe I saw since the early 90s, about $24 million it can cost just in debris cleanup alone.
Gosh. And as you've indicated there, this is a part of America that has seen quite a few storms and hurricanes over the years, but this time, certainly the way the officials have been talking in the lead up to it, does it feel different?
It does feel a little bit different. It does feel as if, especially considering Helene, considering 2 years ago with Hurricane Ian, people are prepared and people are not afraid to ask individuals to evacuate. We were seeing evacuation orders for Sanibel, Captiva Islands, and Fort Myers Beach. Evacuation orders were issued as early as Sunday, asking people to begin evacuations by Monday. So that is some of the earliest I personally have seen in the past decade here in the state of Florida.
Well, stay safe, Tara. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. Tara Callaghan, their reporter with American National Public Radio in Fort Myers. Chad Cronister is the sheriff of the local Hillsborough County. And shortly before we came on air, I asked him what the conditions there were like.
Well, they're getting worse by the minute. The wind speeds continue to pick up as these outer bands start to affect the entire state of Florida as this storm is so large. Along with that, the rain. It's been raining since probably about 6, 7, 8 hours already today. And my fear there is we're getting probably up to a foot of rain in areas that are already overly saturated. Our sanitation systems, our sewage systems, drainage systems are already at capacity from a busy rainy season and Hurricane Helene from 2 weeks ago, and we know that's going to cause some flash flooding.
Tell our listeners, if you will, Sheriff, a bit about the terrain there. What is it that makes the area around Tampa so vulnerable?
Yeah, great question. We're at sea level. Most of Tampa's at sea level, maybe 5, 6, sometimes 20, 25 foot above sea level as you continue to get away from the coast on either side. So that's what makes the damage so catastrophic when you talk about storm surge. 2 weeks ago, it was at 7 foot. If you're at sea level, it's like taking a snow plow and pushing 7 feet of water onto shore. And you can imagine how catastrophic that is. We lost more people here in the Tampa, Florida area than we did where the hurricane made landfall 2 weeks ago.
Many people have heeded the warnings and the calls from people like yourself to leave. But what do you say to those who've decided to stay for whatever reason?
At this point, and as callous as it seems and insensitive as it may appear, you're on your own. What I mean by that is once these wind speeds sustain over 40 miles an hour, it becomes too dangerous for first responders to go out. Hurricane Helene, it never became sustained, so we were able to do 1,000 rescues, and we never had to stop service, answering almost 4,000 calls for service in a 24-hour period. This is going to be different. I hate the fact that someone made the decision to stay, and I'm afraid and can't imagine what that feeling must be when they get to a point and they say, like a lot of people did the last storm, hey, this is too dangerous. I want to leave. I need help getting out of here. When they have to realize no help's coming.
That was Sheriff Chad Cronister from Hillsborough County in Florida. That includes the city of Tampa. It's just to the north of Fort Myers from where we spoke to that reporter with National Public Radio a short while ago. Well, many of the people who have indeed heeded warnings like the one we just heard there from the sheriff. On last night's programme, we spoke to a stoical shop owner who was packing up and leaving. But what about those who, despite it all, are planning to wait out the storm? Well, Stephen Paris lives in Tampa. He works as a manager at a Domino's pizza parlour. So why has he decided to stay?
For a couple of reasons. One, the financial bind it would put us in. We don't have a very big safety net. So if we would have left and then, you know, once the storm passes and we come back, it doesn't guarantee we would be able to come back. I've seen some places over the years since I've lived in Florida, people having to wait weeks to come home. And our area might be fine to be in, but getting back would be a problem. The next thing would be we have animals and belongings we have to consider. What can we take and what do we leave behind? Just a bunch of stuff that is really hard to decide on because you're talking about, you know, driving 7, 8 hours up just to get to Georgia, even the panhandle of Florida. So you can't guarantee that we could get out either.
When you say we, so it's you and your girlfriend and you've got a flatmate and a partner
as
well.
Yeah, so it's my girlfriend and I, our roommate, and her boyfriend who are here right now.
So there's four of you. How big is the place?
It's a three-bedroom house. It's not a small place, but it's not monstrous either. We live on a slope, so all the water kind of rushes to the house.
Right. And have you had experiences of hurricanes before?
I've had a few, but none of them that are this close head-on as Milton. Like Helene, for example, we got the outskirts of her storm where Milton, we're going to be a lot more central with the storm. So the upcoming winds and things like that, I would say I've never experienced before.
So what have you been doing to prepare?
Well, we've got all the necessary supplies the last few days, water, food that we can eat when, you know, the power goes out, because the power will go out. And we actually put the thermostat down as far as we could because it's hot in Florida. So once power goes out, it's going to get hot inside the home. Now, on the outside of the house, we protected our garage, which is the first thing that's going to get massively flooded if it does get that bad. Once the garage floods, it could then enter into the home from a side door. So what we have done, we put some tarps inside and out so that we can kind of keep the water from coming underneath everything. And then we put sandbags on the top of that. For the windows, we're not able to buy plywood and stuff like that. It's too expensive. Like I said, we're kind of on a budget. So we use things like cardboard boxes and tape just in case if wind damage does shatter our windows, it will be very minimal.
So you've thought of a lot, but you've heard President Biden and others have talked about life and death. It's a risk you're prepared to take.
Yeah, I mean, they're all risks. You just never know what a storm will do. Right now, we've been told it went a little bit more south again, which means where we're at here, Tampa, it's not going to be as bad as it once was predicted, but we're still going to be in that 100-mile-an-hour wind. So, you know, it's really difficult to make a decision to leave and stay and all those things. Luckily for us, and, you know, I say that proudly, hoping that we'll get through this no problem, and I do believe so, but we got plenty of our neighbors that stayed behind as well. We've had a few people up the road leave, but we're not fully alone out here, but, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen. And hopefully this storm will kind of die down.
And given that, as you say, you're on a slope, one of the big possible problems is not so much the wind, but the storm surge and the water. Again, what are you prepared for?
Well, we are on a good side of that. We're about 59 feet above, which is about 18 meters above sea level. What our biggest threats here are, we have a swamp in the backyard. Well, behind the backyard, we are fenced in with, you know, there's gators and stuff like that in there. But what we face is we do have little bodies of water, and those little bodies of water around us fill up fast. And we've seen it for just basic tropical storms where they will flood the streets. My biggest concern is if it is as bad as they say it is, how deep are we going to be in the water? We might not get that 12 to 15 feet that the city's going to get. We're about like 15 minutes from there, but we might get that 5 to 6, 7, 8 range that we can't control. And that those are the things that we're more concerned about here.
That was Stephen Paris speaking to me from Tampa in Florida. Coming up later on in the program.
Unless we leave the European Convention on Human Rights. It's called Renewal 2030 because we have to renew. One that leaves the ECHR. We have to renew. And then, by leaving the ECHR. And that renewal is right now.
The last two candidates standing in the race to be the next Conservative Party leader. We'll discuss the messages coming from Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick with two of the party members who will now make the final choice between them. Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have spoken to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for the first time in several weeks. It comes as the fighting between Israel and Hezbollah remains intense. There have been casualties today on both sides of the Lebanese border, and with speculation mounting about Israel's response to Iran's ballistic missile attack last week. President Biden has said he doesn't want America's ally to target Iran's nuclear facilities, but as we're about to hear, some influential voices in Israel are pressing for just that. Well, the readout of the half-hour phone call has been pretty brief. The White House said it was direct and positive, and the leaders would remain in close contact in the coming days. Israel's UN envoy said it was positive, adding, "We appreciate the support of the US." In Israel today, the Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant issued a clear statement of intent.
Whoever attacks us will be hurt and will pay a price. Our attack will be deadly, precise, and above all, surprising. They will not understand what happened and how it happened, but they will see the results.
The BBC's international editor Jeremy Bowen is in Jerusalem, and I asked him about the current mood in Israel.
It is strange. I was down on the coast today in Tel Aviv and in Herzliya. People are going about their business. Doesn't feel like a country at war, though of course it is, and it also affects the way people think and their mindsets, and there could be an air raid at any moment, a missile alert. So yeah, people are nervous about that, but retaliation is certainly coming to Iran. They've made that very clear, the Israelis, and I think two forces are at work here. One is Joe Biden's reluctance to see the US dragged into a war with Iran, which he's doesn't think would be a very good idea, doesn't think would be necessary, doesn't think, the Americans don't think the Iranians were about to create a nuclear weapon, though they do have this nuclear program. But on the other side of that, some Israelis think, wait a minute, we really have an opportunity now to hurt the Islamic regime in Tehran and perhaps even bring about, start the process of trying to bring it down. Now, why are they thinking about that? It's because of the way that Israel has really damaged Hezbollah, particularly in Lebanon. If you like, the forward defenses of Iran, certainly how they see them. So, I mean, this could be, this sounds actually, my assessment would be it is quite dangerous talk. But there are some Israelis who believe this is a once in a generation chance to do damage to their most serious enemy. And now one of them, one of the loudest and most influential on this, is the former Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett, who incidentally is leading some opinion polls as a possible successor, if there was an election, to Benjamin Netanyahu. So I went to visit him, and this is what he had to say.
So we're at the 11th hour, which was not the case 3 years ago. But there's also an ability that didn't exist until now, because essentially Iran was defending itself with two arms, Hezbollah and Hamas. They were sort of its insurance policy against a strike. But now both of those arms are pretty much neutralized.
So the defenses are down, is that what
exactly.
you're saying?
Exactly, and the road is paved. So there's an urgent need that converges with an ability that did not exist, and we have a justification. I don't know what you call a situation where one country shoots 200 ballistic missiles on another. Then you've got Lebanon, who's been shooting tens of thousands of rockets on Israel. You have Hamas, you have the Houthis. There is a regional war taking place, but the head of the octopus that's conducting all this war is the only part that's immune. It's unbelievable if you think about it. All of this mess, all of this chaos, all of this death is being governed and managed from Tehran, yet they are the only ones who are immune.
From Iran's point of view, they might think they're defending themselves, because you think about it, Israel escalated the war in Lebanon. Israel decided to assassinate the leader of Hezbollah, Hassan Nasrallah, a very big ally of theirs. And so they were pushed into a position, weren't they, where they had to respond.
Quite the contrary. You're mistaking the events. What happened was, on October 7th, we were attacked by Hamas. And on October 8th, Israel was unilaterally, out of the blue, attacked by Hezbollah. So now it's a response. What we did in Lebanon to Hezbollah is a response to a whole year of them murdering dozens of Israelis, including 12 children.
Is it the case that really you want the Americans to do it for you? That Israel may start, but you need the Americans to finish, because these sites are in mountains, buried deep. Israel doesn't have the capability, does it?
Israel has the capability to inflict considerable damage on Iran's nuclear program. We are not asking the Americans to do anything. I will point out, though, that just 2 years ago, President Biden signed a commitment, a pledge to Israel that America will prevent Iran from acquiring a nuclear weapon and will use all its tools available to do it. That's their commitment. I'm looking at what we can do. I can tell you we've never asked in our history of America to fight our wars or to send soldiers to fight our wars.
You couldn't fight without them. They've given you in the last year, according to Brown University, nearly $18 billion of extra military aid and an extra almost $5 billion into stepped-up U.S. military operations in the region. In fact, if you were without America, you'd be very lonely, wouldn't you?
We're losing boys. We're losing soldiers fighting the war on behalf of the West. We're doing the dirty work on behalf of the world, the thankless work. We're not asking for thanks, but we are asking, have our back.
Plenty of people would say it might turn it into a much more dangerous place if you don't destroy the facilities, and then Iran decides, right, we're going to go hell for leather for a bomb, and we'll make one.
Right now, it is as clear as ever, we need to act.
Why keep defying Joe Biden and the U.S. administration? Without them, you know, you might be in trouble. The fact is, they're the best friends you could ever want in Israel.
They are. America is an amazing friend.
So why are you saying that the president's got it so wrong?
We have the thankless job of taking out nuclear facilities of the worst regimes in the world. Everyone likes to criticize us, but we're doing that job.
Isn't this a great...
And if they get that bomb, it's everyone's problem. It's not our problem. I want to see how Londoners will feel when there's a intercontinental ballistic missile with a nuclear bomb. We cannot allow that to happen.
Now, you're out of politics at the moment, but the polls say that you are the favorite of many Israelis. If there was an election tomorrow, they'd vote for you. They want you to be prime minister. So are you doing this as a vote winner? I mean, this is popular, what you're saying.
I don't think it's popular. I think it's the right thing to do.
Popular in Israel?
I don't know if it's popular in Israel or not. I haven't done a poll. It's the right thing to do for the future of your children, my children, of the world.
Naftali Bennett there. And Jeremy, that relationship, that key relationship between Israel and the United States, you've seen a lot over the years, but how would you assess it at the moment?
Well, I think the relationship, it's not just about Israel, it's about Benjamin Netanyahu and various presidents, and particularly Democratic presidents. He has had an appalling relationship with the Democratic presidents he's had to deal with. First was Bill Clinton back in the 90s. Then there was Barack Obama and, more recently, of course, President Joe Biden. And he has really got their backs up. He's antagonized them. Clinton famously, after their first meeting, said, "Who is the effing superpower here?" Because he'd just been lectured by Netanyahu, who was then a man in his 40s, about the same age, I think, as Clinton himself. In the course of this last year, America has given incredible support, unconditional support, effectively, to Israel, while rather mildly asking, "Look, we'd really prefer it if you didn't kill as many civilians in Gaza." Joe Biden has basically been ignored on that by Netanyahu. But on Iran, it is different. They sense the stakes, the Americans sense the stakes are much higher, that an attack on the nuclear facilities there, it might not even be successful. Perhaps not even if the Americans did it, because some of them are buried really deep inside mountains. And that would start off a lot of things. Most dangerously, it could then be the impetus, the excuse, the reason some Iranians wanted to start the process of breaking out of the various arms control agreements and actually building a nuclear weapon. And that would be a very dangerous moment indeed. And the Americans do not want Israeli action to bring that on.
The BBC's international editor, Jeremy Bowen, we heard him earlier there speaking to the former Israeli Prime Minister, Naftali Bennett. Quick reminder, if you want to listen back to any of this programme or to previous ones, you can go to BBC Sounds, where you can also download the podcast. The main headline so far on The World Tonight, millions of Florida residents have fled their homes to escape Hurricane Milton, which officials say will be deadly and catastrophic. And the US President Joe Biden has spoken to the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in a phone call. A readout said the leaders spoke about the urgent need to renew diplomacy to release the hostages held by Hamas. And they also discussed Israel's response to Iran's missile attack and pledged to remain in close contact in the coming days. Now, there's been a shock in the Conservative Party leadership race, with the former Home and Foreign Secretary James Cleverly failing to make it into the final two, despite coming top in the previous poll of MPs a whole 24 hours ago. In today's second and decisive vote, the parliamentary party put in first place the former Business Secretary Kemi Badenoch, a combative performer known for her stance on cultural issues, and in second place, former Immigration Minister Robert Jenrick, who has embraced a tough line towards his former brief. It will now be down to party members to make the final choice between them. We'll get an early sense of those members' views in just a minute. First, though, let's hear about the reaction in Westminster as the result was announced today. Newsnight's political editor Nick Watt was in the room when it happened, Committee Room 14 to be precise.
There were audible gasps in the room when that result was read out, because James Cleverly, supposedly the front-runner, was, of course, knocked out. Nobody was expecting that to happen. There was a Tory peer sitting behind me, and he said, "Sensational, couldn't believe it." And everyone fled out of the room to try and find out what had happened. A lot of speculation. Had votes been lent? A lot of people saying maybe not, because nobody had got to the magic 41, which means you're definitely through. Assume you keep all your supporters. There was some chat that maybe there's some former senior ministers who fancy themselves as sort of Francis Urquhart House of Cards characters who were sort of moving around, had supported James cleverly to inflate his support, made him complacent, and then they pulled their support. So now what happens is that the Conservative membership have a choice between two candidates on the right, Kemi Badenoch and Robert Jenrick, although interestingly they're both using careful language, both talking about trying to seek the common ground.
BBC Newsnight's Nick Watt there. Common ground may be, but they do differ on one policy that is important to Conservative Party members, and that's immigration. Speaking after the result was announced, Robert Jenrick said that leaving the European Convention on Human Rights, the ECHR, would continue to be central to his message.
I believe passionately that the UK needs to leave the ECHR. We will never control our borders. We will not get foreign criminals out of our country. And we will not secure our border unless we do that. You cannot reform it. You cannot ignore it. But it's not the only issue that the public care about. And throughout the campaign, I've said we've got to find ways of growing the economy by giving people real skills, by tackling welfare, by having a different energy policy as a country. And we've got to obsess about our public services because we need to be a party that the public trust on the NHS as much as our borders.
Kemi Badenoch has rejected that idea of leaving the ECHR as what she called an easy answer to immigration, but she agrees with her rival that the final stage of this contest needs to cover the broadest range of issues.
We need to adapt. We need to change our economy. Let's get some more money so that we can spend it on defence. Let's get more people out to work. Let's talk about the NHS. It can't just be about one little part of immigration policy. We need to lower immigration. That is part of the story. But just talking about the ECHR is going to shut down the conversation that we need to have with the entire country. And that's what I'm about.
Kemi Badenoch. Well, let's hear from a couple of Conservative Party members now. Joining us to discuss the final two, Conservative councillor, leader of the opposition on the City of Wolverhampton Council, Simon Bennett. Good evening, Simon.
Good evening.
And a familiar voice to listeners of this programme, chair of the Sussex Weald Conservative Association, Daphne Bagshaw. Good evening. Welcome back, Daphne.
Good evening. Good evening.
Now, Simon, you are a Jenrick man through and through, aren't you? Why is that?
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, first and foremost, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a prime minister that was raised in Wolverhampton? Wouldn't that be absolutely great?
Ah, yes. He's a local. Like me, he's a local man, isn't he? Yes.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So first and foremost. But now, beyond that, I think he's the right man to actually bring the party back together, unite the members with the party and the organisation itself. First and foremost, where that distance has sort of been greatly exacerbated over the last number of years, but actually bring the country back together as well. I think it's the big opportunity we've got to actually offer something to the electorate once again to vote for us. And I think Robert's that man to do that.
And Daphne, you were a James Cleverly backer, weren't you?
But Yes, I was.
But he's not available for you to vote for. So who are you going for?
Well, I am at the, going to go for Badenoch, I think. But I do want to say that I think both these candidates have got a huge amount in common. They overlap to a tremendous degree. So whichever one wins, I think the party can unite behind them. I'm going for Badenoch because I feel that she understands that we need to really revivify the party from top to bottom and in every part of its structure, because it really isn't fit for purpose.
Well, is that a good or a bad thing to be choosing between two similar candidates, or might it be better to have different candidates and perhaps a clearer fight in some ways?
Well, I don't necessarily think that. But what I am concerned with this, if you think about it, whoever is elected leader will only have been the first choice of one third of the MPs, because they're more or less split into three. I mean, not exactly, but jolly nearly, 42, 41, 37. So one of them's going to come through. And what we're all going to have to do is unite behind them. That is vital. The country will not vote for a divided party, especially a divided party that's failed in so many other ways. So we have to pull ourselves together and get going.
You're going to be hearing a lot from both of them now over the next couple of weeks. I mean, clearly, both your minds, well, I sense perhaps yours hasn't totally been made up, Daphne, but I mean, Simon, yours already has. But what do you want to hear from Robert Jenrick then? You talked about unity, you talked about bringing the country together. He if he wins, he's going to be the leader of the opposition, which I suppose is a different sort of role. What do you want to hear from him?
Yeah, I think to be honest, it's more of what he's been put himself forward for over the last number of weeks since he launched his campaign. I think it's been clearer to me that he's the man that I want to support, because he wants to not only be in opposition and be the leader of the opposition and take the fight to Labour. You know, we've got a disastrous Labour government at the moment that's self-imploding. He actually wants to be Prime Minister as well beyond that. And that's where, if we want to get back into government, we actually have to have that ambition, not just to be leader of the opposition, but actually to get back into government. And within 5 years, and yes, it's a difficult task, and yes, it's a challenge, but for people like myself, and I'm sure for Daphne as well, as grassroots activists and volunteers and councillors, we want to be back in as soon as possible, and actually because we're in this to make change, positive change for the country. We're not in this just to win elections. This is about making lives better for people.
Well, you need to win elections to be able to do that, I suppose, would be the comeback. But Daphne, you said it was a positive thing that these were from a similar wing of the party, but others might argue, actually, does that not worry you that you might be losing the centre ground if you are going for a candidate very much on the right of the party?
No, I didn't say that they were the same wing of the party. I said they overlapped in many ways, and they do, because they're both Tories. That's the point. We need to be opposing socialism. That's what we need to be opposing. We're here to fight Keir Starmer. We're not here to sort of, as it were, try and win back people like Farage. We're opposing Starmer, not appeasing Farage. And I do believe that the elections are won from the middle ground, but that's not why you are in the middle ground. You're in the middle ground because that's what you believe in. And that's why I like Kemi Badenoch. She tells me what she believes in. And that, I think, is a very good thing.
Interesting.
If I can't have Cleverly, you know.
You'll have Kemi. Right. Well, what about that point, Simon, that Kemi Badenoch has perhaps been talking less about specific issues and more about the fundamentals, if you like?
So I disagree. I think, you know, this is one of the reasons why I'm backing Rob. He's absolutely clear on what he wants to do and has the substance and backing and has got a track record that you can look back through in government to say that he will be able to deliver. He is the common ground candidate. To Daphne's point, they are quite different as well. They're not actually that much the same. They are very different stances. You look on the ETHR particularly, it's leave or remain. That's the choice now between Kemi and Robert. And it's a leave or remain.
Well, the debate will continue. Thank you both very much for joining us. Simon Bennett, Daphne Bagshaw. Now, one issue we've been following here on The World Tonight is the growing number of people leaving the workforce and the impact that has had on the economy. Some of you have got in touch about your experience, and with the new government's first budget fast approaching, we thought we would check in with you again, especially after a survey this week which found almost half of recruiters think that 57-year-olds are too old to be considered for a job, a finding which struck a particular chord here in The World Tonight studio. So if that kind of attitude or any other reason is keeping you away from regular employment, do let us know. You can contact us via email on world.tonight@bbc.co.uk, or you can send us a WhatsApp message 03700 100 444 or via text on 84844. Now, Paris, from Paris and Prague to from Leningrad to London, many places have had pieces of classical music named after them. And now a Sussex coastal town known for its links with Billy Butlin is joining that list. It's thought for the very first time. The Bognor Regis Suite No. 1, a piece for two trombones and a string orchestra, will get its premiere on Saturday. I've been speaking to its composer, local jeweller and musician Roger Claydon, and he talked me through his own daily routine in his hometown and how it inspired his music.
Quite often I get up early and I go and swim in the sea and the sun's just coming out, and then I can go to the park and have a walk where I've been walking for years. You know, it's like a time walk. It's incredible. And then, of course, we've got the extremely busy Butlins, which has loads of people turning up all the time. They hit the station, pack it out, then go to Butlins, then go back the other way, pack the place out. And I've had them coming in my shop for about 30 years now, gradually, you know. So I've sort of done a lightish sort of thing for them. I think it just about gets it right.
Well, let's talk about the three movements. You start with Sunrise. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yes, yes. Sunrise is lovely. It's just two trombones to start with. And then after about six, seven bars, in comes one of the violins just with pizzicato plucking, which is the beginning of the sun rising. We've got this gradual moving movement the whole time. And the trombones just carry on absolutely steady, like the sun rising, you know.
And once the sun has risen, you're up and about, it's time for a walk.
That's it. Hotham Park is the place. Now, I imagine, and I've shown my customers, it's sort of about 1850 and people walking around. They used to walk around with one sort of arm up in the air, a bit like a teapot, you know, with all the time in the world, walking around like that in these great big dresses and things like that, you know.
So this is the second movement. It's called A Walk in Hotham Park.
Well, Lord Hotham made it at the beginning of the 1800s and had a beautiful house in it. And when I was a tiny boy, I used to go there, and they had this lovely zoo, including a bear which escaped and went ransacked round Butlins.
That brings us to the third movement, of course, which is Butlins March.
Of course, March, because the March, people coming in and out of my shop and going off, you know, with a certain amount of humour. The trombones started off, they play the theme, and then the violins all together, and then we have a lovely end piece with the trombone doing a trill right at the top, and then ending on a lovely chord.
What does it mean to you, then, to actually have written a piece about the town you clearly love?
We're starting to get it into music, what Bognor's really about. All the people in Bognor as well make it happen, and what it's really like living here, you know, day to day.
You've been playing in Bognor Regis, what, for half a century now, haven't you?
Oh, a long, long time, yes.
I've been reflecting as I've been preparing for this, all the great composers who've written pieces of music dedicated to cities and towns, from Mozart to Vaughan Williams to Shostakovich. Roger Claydon, is that a name that's going to live on, do you think? An association with Bognor?
It would be lovely if it did. I've never heard anyone writing a Bognor Regis suite, you know, before. And I hope it's the beginning of something, you know. I know people could write lots of things about Bognor, but one piece of music can go above all of that, you know. That's what I've tried to do.
Roger Claydon and the music he's written for Bognor Regis. And if you want to hear that performed in concert as opposed to that software-generated version from Roger's computer, the world premiere is at the Genesis Community Centre in Bognor Regis on Saturday evening. That is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. For now, from me and everyone here, good night.